When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This week's edition of the Nitty Gritty Committee requires a trigger warning. We'll be discussing suicidal ideation and childhood sexual assault.
There's my trauma, but then I deal with hundreds of victims hearing their traumatic experiences. And then when you multiply that, you know, year by year, it was just, you know, the trauma. It wasn't personal trauma only. It was also vicarious trauma. Yeah. And that's when you start getting nightmares about those types of things. When you hear a parent is telling you about the fact that he's just found out that a parent has been abusing their child for the last four years, and they have Sabbath meals with them every year, and, you know, the perpetrator and the victim are both there in the room at the same table. Mm-hmm. How do you address these things? And much more common story than people actually believe happens.
That's the voice of Manny Wax, who was raised in Melbourne as a member of an ultra-Orthodox sect of Judaism, as the second of 17 children. The family's entire life revolved around their family home and the yeshiva centre across the street where they went to school. Every single person they knew from yeshiva. As a child, Manny was sexually abused by two of those people, and as a grown-up, he blew the whistle on the issue of child sexual abuse in the Orthodox Jewish community. It didn't go down very well. I'm Michelle Laurie, and this is the Nitty Gritty Committee, stories about the guts and the glory of life. And in this episode, we hear from survivor Manny Wax, author of Who Gave You Permission, available in bookstores now. And you can also follow Manny's travels on Facebook. So I'm not finished the book yet, so I don't know how it ends. Don't wreck it for me. But I must say the first chapters were really unexpected to me and really sort of exciting, because I was learning so much about Chabad. Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you. I lived around that neighbourhood for years. You and I probably crossed paths 1,000 times around the Balaclava area of Melbourne, around St Kilda.
Yep.
And I saw you guys walking around. I kind of got the big hats and stuff, but I didn't understand what it meant and what... So much ritual and symbolism.
Look, I mean, it's still very confusing, because I'm sure you're saying the big hats, but you know what? Even within the hats fraternity, within the ultra-Orthodox community, there are massive variations.
Yeah.
So someone who you think may be Chabad is completely not, because it depends on the style of hat,
okay,
how much he bends down the front of it. It really gets very specific.
And we have no idea in Australia how many variations there are in our Jewish community, I don't think.
No, it's... Yeah. Well, look, many of us probably don't realise about the same thing about the Aboriginal community.
Yes, you're
so right. Different languages and all that. So
we just don't
interact as much as probably we should.
And that's interesting too, because as Australians we tend to get freaked out about the idea of people coming here and not integrating. I'm reading your book and I'm going, wow, I don't think most of us realise that your community was not integrated with mainstream Australia.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't watch television, you weren't allowed to see movies, read novels.
That's right. I mean, our lives, I'm just going to talk about the past for me, but, mm-hmm. you know, their lives in the Chabad community or ultra-Orthodox community revolves around religion. So from the moment you wake up till the time you go to sleep, the main aim of Chabad in particular, as opposed to some of the other groups, is... With every waking hour of the day, you need to be thinking about what are we going to do to make the Messiah come sooner.
Ah,
And we say that every day. I believe, ani ma'amin be'emunah, I believe in full faith that the Messiah is going to come imminently. And what that means is he's going to save the world, there's going to be peace, and we won't get into all the specifics of it, but, you know, all the Jews apparently are supposed to be going to Israel, and the temple is supposed to come, the third temple.
Right.
So that's what we're supposed to be striving towards.
How do we say that? Mashiach?
Mashiach.
Mashiach. Now, the reason that's on my mind is because I lived in the neighborhood.
Yep.
And I remember seeing posts like, yeah, big banners around saying Moshiach.
He's on the way.
He's coming. Yep. Yeah. And there was a van and everything. Okay. Yep. So that's what that's about.
And the photo you would have seen of the person next to it, yes, is the Lubavitcher Rebbe or the Chabad. So Lubavitcher is another word, another way of saying Chabad. It's simply the town in Russia where Chabad came from.
Oh.
So they have a picture of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, after whom I'm named, Menachem, because
yep,
that was his name, Menachem Mendel. And the belief was, while he was alive, is that he is the Messiah. That's what we grew up believing, mm-hmm, that he was going to reveal himself.
Mm-hmm.
When we are worthy to receive him, then he will reveal himself.
So much pressure.
That's right. In every generation, they tell us that there is at least one person who's got the potential to be the Messiah, and it's up to us, the community, the society, to be in a position where we're ready to accept him, so that if he reveals himself, he will not run into hiding because we've just let him down. So
that's the world that you grew up in as a little boy. You're the second of 17 children. And just the pressure as I was reading those early chapters was astounding to me. I've got a six-year-old son. I've got six-year-old twins, actually, boy and girl. But I'm imagining my little boy, Chewy Louie. Go ahead if you want to blow. My little boy, Chewy Louie, with the amount of pressure that you had younger brothers and sisters all the time. You had sort of a buddy system in your family.
That's right. I mean, I'm the second oldest and the oldest boy, and everyone, once you get to a certain age, I think we're about 7, 8, 9, we started being responsible for the younger one, because it was almost literally one a year, every child. There's a year separating my older sister and myself, and then it's like a year and 1 month between me and the next, and then a year and 2 or 3 months, and then, you know, eventually you'll miss 1 year. And so, you know, the biggest difference is like a year and a half between kids.
Wow.
So, you know, that's 17 kids within 21 years.
Yes.
We all had to pull our weight.
Yeah, so you've got the pressure of pulling your weight, of taking care of the little ones, of the normal household duties, and also of being such a great Jewish kid that the Messiah will come back.
That's right.
Wow. So,
exactly. I mean, our entire lives really did encapsulating our involvement with the Yeshiva Center. You wake up in the morning, you go across the road into the ritual bath, which was in the Yeshiva Center. You go to synagogue, which is at the center. You go to school. You go to after school activities on the Sabbath. And even, you know, if we had a bit of spare time to play, there was a whole playground there. We didn't need to play in our front or backyard. We just played at the Yeshiva Center.
And you didn't need to go to a park where there were other kids, other non-Jewish kids. It was all over there.
Yeah, and we didn't even need any other kids, Jewish or non-Jewish, because we'd just say, who wants to play basketball? And we easily had three on three.
16 brothers and sisters. Yeah, you're not looking for other kids to play with.
So I enjoyed, you know, the focus on family and on celebration and really just that community, sense of community, is always very reassuring, and you just
have felt very protected and very, very safe.
From the outside,
from us.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, you wrote in your book that you didn't know the difference between Jesus and Hitler when you were little.
I know, and it sounds crazy to a lot of people when they hear that. They've asked me, really? And to me, it was a blur. I mean, it was one and the same, just like I didn't know my English birthday till the age of 15.
Yeah.
I would always go by the Hebrew calendar.
Yeah.
So, these things were all alien to me. I had no idea. I mean, I'd heard of the name Jesus. I heard of the name of Hitler. And obviously, to me, they were both wicked people.
Turned on the Jews,
causing a lot of death and destruction. And, you know, it's horrible. I used to walk past the church and we used to spit.
Oh, really?
Spit on the side.
Wow.
And when I think about it, it's disgusting. It is absolutely disgusting. And then it's, you know, when people, we talk about the issue of anti-Semitism and people attacking us. And I copped heaps of anti-Semitism growing up, as you were saying before, the black hats there. So I was a walking target, and plenty of times they threw eggs at us. You know, the more common thing was yelling from a fast-moving car for effing Jews and that kind of stuff. But the reverse racism, you know, every morning, for example, and I do write this in the book, we make a blessing. Thank you, Lord, for not making me a Gentile.
Non-Jew.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Lord. The other one is, just to top it off, not just anti-Gentiles, but sexist. Thank you, God, for not making me a woman.
I love that one.
So, you know, and there are people who interpret it in different ways. You know, have a rabbi sitting here and justifying and say, well, it's not really that we're thanking that he's not. He just, by that, we mean that we're thankful for he made us for who we are.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. You know, I'm as skeptical as you are, really.
Well, I mean, I found it, to be honest, when I read that in your book, I found it quaint. I thought, oh, bless. Good. I'm so glad you're not women. Great. Good for you.
I hope all little Gentiles have your kind of attitude.
Well, you know, I'm very forgiving and open-minded because, and you're right, I've seen anti-Semitism at work in that neighbourhood and lots of places. But also you talk about the racism within the Jewish culture as well, these sects against each other. And there was a lot of spitting on each other and stuff as well.
Astounding. I think, you know, for us, we grew up with the expectation that there'll be anti-Semitism because mm-hmm. that's what we're taught. We're taught about some of our past and the pogroms. So the Holocaust was never like a massive. We heard about it. And again, that's why there's that confusion between Hitler and Jesus. But also, what was more common that we were taught was about Russia and the pogroms there before the Holocaust.
Wow. That's,
and I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that our Hasidic forebearers, the people who, you know, the Chabad is only 250-odd years old, a bit more, 300 years max. And that's where the Hasidic movement really stemmed from, the person before the Chabad movement, so the Baal Shem Tov. He was the one responsible for the Hasidic movement, and out of him came probably dozens of different groups.
Yeah.
So, and it came from the shtetls in Russia and all that. So that was how our introduction to,
Well, you know, Christianity is the same, obviously. I mean, all these religions are sects.
That's right.
Of Christianity, and they turn on each other every couple of hundred years. And aren't we ridiculous?
Exactly. But, you know, like, I think what hurt more was the internal racism.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when we moved in from Israel to Sydney briefly for a year and a half, and then we went to Melbourne. For the first weekends, every Sabbath, pretty much, at least that's how we felt like, and I speak to this about with my siblings once in a while, and we remember it as a very traumatic period because, you know, we used to get there and they used to catch us one at a time and either, you know, attack us verbally or physically and be really disgusting, you know.
The other Jewish kids.
Yeah, not just Jewish kids, the ultra-Orthodox kids, you know, who were, you know, studying. You know, sometimes even the parents were involved and sometimes the teachers were involved in calling some of my siblings. I never got called a bung, but you abo, dirty black. But they had other names for all of us, which is dibs, dirty Israeli bastards. You know, exactly.
And I thought Israel was the ultimate.
That's where it all gets confusing.
But it's so confusing.
It is. And then we got called Palestinians because
you're dark-skinned?
Well, no, we're Israeli for that, but then because we resorted to the weapons of the weak because they used to attack us physically and there were dozens of them.
Uh-huh.
So we found some stones and we started throwing it at them and then we became Palestinians. So, as you can imagine, those types of things were confronting. And I was the oldest boy out of my, you know, I had five boys under me. So we were the ones who were involved regularly in the assaults that were going on. I guess that's how it would be described. And I remember some of the parents or teachers getting involved in this, and that used to be really hurtful because they're people who're supposed to protect us.
Yeah.
And my father couldn't do anything. He spoke to the big rabbi about it, and they ignored it completely. So. That was the first introduction we had to the Melbourne Chabad community.
Mm.
And then eventually, look, we learned to live with it. The ongoing racism, just like we learned to deal with the anti-Semitism outside of the institution, we learned to deal with that internally. Eventually, we stuck up for ourselves as well because we realised, you know, let's do it as a team. And then I remember one incident, actually, I can't remember if we put it in the book, but they took one of my brothers and chucked him in a rubbish bin. So we identified who the person was and then we cornered him and four or five of us got there and grabbed him and chucked him in the rubbish bin. And that actually changed the dynamics a little bit. That really realized we'll fight back.
The Wax family.
That's it.
Were you a big family by standards, by the neighbourhood standards?
Yes.
Even by
yes.
those standards?
I would say the average in the Chabad community growing up, well, there were many families with, you know, 10, 12, 17 was a step above.
Yeah, wow. I don't know how your mum did it physically. It's incredible. How old are your youngest?
20 or 21.
Oh, okay. So all grown up now.
Yes, because the oldest is 41. I'm 40 and the youngest is 20. So it's like a 21 years difference between the oldest and youngest. And the youngest is about to get married next month in Los Angeles.
Wow. Do you all manage to have relationships? Are there any that you don't really have much of a relationship with? Or is this
we need to do a whole podcast separately just on that, on the family dynamics. It does also evolve. It changes depending on a whole lot of different circumstances. You know, there are age gap issues. There are geography issues in terms of where everyone is living. There are 17 of us. There's, you know, a few in Melbourne, a few in Sydney, a few in Florida, in New York, and in Israel. If I haven't missed anyone. And then there are a few who are kind of been traveling and different places. So it's difficult to really keep the family, I don't know, if not united, then even to have dialogue is difficult.
Do you have a WhatsApp group or something like that that everyone's in it?
Not everyone.
Okay. There's
differences of opinion, and then some people are busier than others and don't have the patience to deal with a lot of the nonsense that goes around as well. So there's a lot. Can you imagine, in every family, as I see it, there's family politics.
Yeah.
And the average Australian family is about, 2.1 or something?
Yeah, there's five people in my absolutely.
Exactly. So we're talking about here.
And even then there's politics.
That's right. And if there's one person that's, you know, people aren't talking to, that's one out of two or three, not a big deal. But if you multiply us by we're five or six times the average family size, then you're going to have five, six times the family politics.
Yeah.
So it does get interesting at times.
Have the family politics been affected by your
Without
life?
Doubt.
Okay, which we need to obviously get into and broach. Yeah, absolutely. I first became aware of you in 2011 through an article in the Age newspaper in Melbourne. And it was talking about the fact that you were sexually molested at the yeshiva.
Yep.
Across the road from your house, where your whole world was.
Yep.
Which is terrible. But there was another level to all of this, which was that your family was sort of being bullied by the community for coming forward and talking about it to the outside world.
Yeah, I think as I've said a number of times before, the abuse was one thing. You know, there are some horrible people in this world who are sick. Yeah. I don't like to use the word sick because often people use that as an excuse. He's sick, you know, there's an illness there, so he can't be helped almost. But there are some evil people out there, however we define them.
What I found so just sad, for want of a better word, just heartbreaking, was the idea that when you were a little boy, you're 11 or 12, and you've been assaulted and you told your best friend who clearly told other people.
Yes.
And so you ended up in a situation where the other kids and you believed adults knew what had happened to you and like started calling you a poofter and all of this kind of stuff and reacting to you in that way.
Yeah, that was very painful. I remember dealing with the abuse, so what I actually went through and was going through at the time, and then getting to school, you know, away, trying to get away from everything, and then you're constantly called all sorts of names, poofter, gay, and if you accidentally, you know, while you're playing basketball or whatever game, you touch someone, you can see the smirks, you can see the laughs, and then you can also hear the teasing often in front of adults, in front of teachers. And it was horrible. It was really horrible because there was no one to talk to about it.
No.
My best friend at the time betrayed me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can forgive that aspect because we all do silly things when we're young, especially if it might work in our interest to get a bit more popular. But it was a nightmare, and therefore it exacerbated the pain. There's no question about it. And therefore, I guess in many ways I continued and responded in a destructive way, I think.
Yeah. Well, your first abuser also came from a very well-connected family, right? And in fact, you were very close to his grandfather, was it?
Yes, very close.
And he had some funny views. The abuser had some funny views about children and, sex anyway, didn't he, that he had expressed.
Well, to my father, mentioned that to me later on, exactly, that there was some question marks that basically the can't be such thing as sexual abuse on boys because they wanted it. I'm still unclear. I can't remember the exact details about it all, but it was conveyed to me by my father. Obviously, at the time, we didn't know 100% that that's what he was doing.
Yeah.
My parents didn't know.
Yeah. There was a second abuser, though, who was a man at the school who was a security person. So he was very well respected and relied upon to keep everyone safe on the grounds.
Yeah, and even more than that, in his case, he was a hero to many of us kids because he used to be the tough guy, the black belt in karate, dealing with any anti-Semitic issues or when non-Jews would come onto the yeshiva center. I remember so many times he'd just make sure that they'd get off the property. Yeah. And even if they were double, three times the size of him, he wasn't a big bloke, but his fearlessness always impressed us, and we wanted to be like him. He was the karate teacher. So
yeah, I know through conversations I've had with some of the Ballarat survivors of the Catholic perpetrators that a lot of them were assaulted by more than one person.
Yes, it's very common, and a lot of victims who I interact with over the years say to me, it's as if I had the big letter V on my forehead that come and abuse me.
Yeah.
And I share it with them, and I know that they feel a little bit more at ease if they don't already know that I was abused by two people. It's very common. I don't feel like I did anything in particular to attract it, but they find vulnerabilities. That's the expertise and experience of these perpetrators. They find vulnerabilities, and they will...
exploit them.
That's the word I was looking for. Exploit them to the best of their ability, and it's no wonder that many perpetrators have dozens and dozens of victims.
Yeah, and also again with the Catholic families, a lot of them were big families.
Yes,
a lot of these were kids with a lot of siblings. Yes. So when you offer to come and pick the kid up and drive them somewhere or take care of a job like that every week, the parents go, "Thank you, great."
Yeah, and there's no way the parents can be there.
No.
Emotionally, physically, in a way that they need to be with so many kids.
Yeah.
It's impossible, and I've told that to my parents as much as I think that they did a relatively good job under the circumstances because, again, you've got to contextualize it all in their environment, their community, the expectation. I mean, they've got a blessing from the Lubavitcher Rebbe to have
many
a large
children.
Family.
Yeah.
So, you know, from their perspective, it's a lot of respect and a lot of wonderful things, but... you cannot be there you need to be there as a parent when your child comes home. There needs to be at least one parent greeting, how was your day, are you hungry, to pick up any signs of distress. Yeah. You cannot do that when you've got so many kids.
You talk about in the book about looking forward to the weekly ear clean because your mum used to line all of you up and come and clean your ears, and it was an intimate, close moment between you and your mum. They were hard to come by.
Yeah, I do. I don't know about weekly, but certainly when it did happen, it was nice. And you know, it was. I remember it. I don't know why, but I guess perhaps it's because there wasn't that just quiet time, loving and sitting. It was, you know, there were a lot of very nice, lovely times around the Sabbath table and singing and dancing at the festivals and all that.
Right.
So there were a lot of those types of fun moments, but those are different moments than love, because most of the time, the word love would have been used in the context of loving the Lubavitcher Rebbe, loving the Bible, loving Hashem, loving your fellow Jew. It was never about loving a family member.
Yeah.
There was never parents or children saying to each other, "I love you." That was very foreign.
Okay. So, but you're part of this very big, very strong community. Was there a siege mentality, do you think, in terms of, you know, the world is against us, there are so many, there's so much evidence to suggest that we as a people, you know, are targets, and so we need to band together?
Yes, but it would be a very different perspective to many others in the Jewish community who may not be Orthodox and would have that siege mentality.
Yes.
Where especially second and third generation Holocaust survivors in Australia, in particular, because we've got the second highest concentration of such people. But in the ultra-Orthodox world, it's not only in relation to non-Jews, it's also in relation to secular Jews that may be trying to make us less religious. So there's suspicion of the other, no matter who they are, unless they are us. Not just, again, secular Jews, but when I think about it, it's also there is suspicion and immense dislike of other ultra-Orthodox Jews.
Well, I remember in 2011 when your report first came out, a friend of mine, Jewish friend of mine, who's virtually pretty much non-practicing, I would say, I was saying to him, I don't understand. Why are they so angry with him? And he said, oh, I think it's because Jewish people feel like we get enough criticism. We don't, you know, we're sort of a fear factor. And so maybe they feel like Manny is inviting criticism on the whole community.
There is no question about that.
That was from,
again, that was mainly from the non-Orthodox necessarily. I mean, the ultra-Orthodox is very different because they are a very close community. They deal with everything inside, minimize interaction with the outside world. So that is much broader than what we've just discussed. Whereas the issue of inviting anti-Semitism and the like, that was something that was thrown my way repeatedly. But again, less by the Orthodox. It was more non-Orthodox, and often by those second, third generation Holocaust survivors, who feel okay, you know, okay, you mentioned it. We understand you needed justice. But why do you have to keep on going at it? Because every time we see your name by Stormfront and all these organizations, anti-Semitic organizations saying, you see, even the Jews are pedophiles now. Oh. And they're like, you know, and my response is, these people are anti-Semites. It's not as if they need extra fodder to make them anti-Semites. They will use anything they see. Bernie Madoff is Jewish. And he was a horrible person. So they'll use that. You know, did he do it as a Jew? No, he did it because he's a horrible human being. Mm-hmm. And he ripped off many, many people. And he's rightfully sitting in jail now. But, you know, of course, the anti-Semites will use it and highlight the fact that he is Jewish.
I didn't even realize they were using you in that way.
Yes, oh, yes, wow, yes. Okay. I was sent a lot of articles. Look at what they're doing now. So, you know, and I did feel guilty about it. But I felt, you know, the reality is... There is no choice. We needed to address this issue, and the ones who are probably causing anti-Semitism are those leaders and rabbis who have responded to this issue in a reprehensible manner.
Yeah.
They are the ones. Imagine if I brought this issue to light and then all of a sudden everyone welcomed it and in the Jewish community and the leadership, and they said, we're now bringing in policies and procedures. This is unacceptable. All of these people are going to resign. You know, all of this thing that I'm just telling you now, they've happened, but happened after many years,
yes,
with a heavy price to many people, including myself and my family. So
let's get into that. So as a teenager then, I guess the abuse stopped when you were about 13, 14?
14 and a half, something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Why did it stop, by the way? Did you...
You know, I can't even tell you the exact time that it did stop. The reason I suspect it was about 14 and a half was because there was that mikveh incident where I was sexually abused inside the male ritual bath. And that was the most traumatic impact, the most traumatic experience for me by far.
Because that's a very important ritualistic space, isn't
absolutely,
it?
So. Absolutely. And I remember also, I mean, I blacked out temporarily when I was sitting on the floor in the drying room. And it really, that it haunts me to this day. I mean, when I close my eyes sometimes and I think about the abuse, that is where that takes me. And I, you know, my family home is not far from this. It was really a horrible place to go and think about. But I seem to recall that was pretty much the end of it after then. And I never spoke to him ever again. So it was the age of about 14.
So from there, your behaviour changed, definitely. Your schoolwork, all of those things that now we know are classic markers of a child who's been assaulted, and other classic markers as well. You started to rebel against religion.
Yeah.
I mean, how did your dad cop that?
Yeah.
Well, you weren't even wearing the, is it yarmulke?
Yarmulke, exactly. The kippah on the head, head covering.
You stopped wearing the uniform of the...
That's right. I rebelled in every possible way within the Orthodox community. It's not as if I was, you know, certainly not before the age of 15. I wasn't doing any drugs, doing a little bit of alcohol in the early stage, but that became a lot worse, so that's as bad as it got. But, you know, rebelling, I mean, I'm talking about switching the lights on and off on the Sabbath.
On the Sabbath,
and, you know, eating not kosher food for, you know, someone outside the Jewish community.
But it did exacerbate, didn't it? As you got into your late teens, I mean, we're talking about visiting prostitutes.
Yes.
Alcohol.
Yes.
Lots of...
Other substances,
And your parents kind of giving you the attic room to just keep you away from the other kids. So
that was already when I came back from Israel.
Right.
Because I went to Israel at the age of 18 into the army. I just needed to get away from here.
Yeah, of course.
From the community.
But then you were naughty in the army.
I was.
You ended up in jail?
I did.
For a couple of days.
I did.
I mean, now it's so hard to imagine because I think of you as so mild-mannered and gentle, and I'm reading all this stuff going, wow, that's an intense period in Manny's life.
It was.
When did it change? When did you think I've got to face what this really is? Did you know what it really was?
No. Throughout this period, I had no idea. I knew I was carrying a big burden. I knew I was very angry because there were constant triggers that were happening, and it was easy to shut it down back then because I didn't really have, you know, a family for a couple of years. Also, I didn't even talk to my parents briefly, we didn't have internet and phones like we do now. This was talking about mid-90s, so I felt very much alone, and I did my own thing, and I abused a lot of substances, and so it was easy to escape.
Yeah,
I didn't to deal with it. But then when I got back to Australia in the year 2000, after 6 years in Israel, I tried pursuing justice, and the police weren't able to assist. They claimed lack of evidence.
Okay.
Because in 96 I came back for my sister's wedding. I was 20 years old then. I happened to hear on the radio something about providing any information to the police if you have any information about child sexual abuse. So that's when I addressed it and I went to the rabbi. So the police and the rabbi weren't willing to assist me or unable to assist me. So then I went back to Israel with... That's when I ended up staying in Australia for 5 months instead of 1 month, which got me into jail because I overstayed my...
Well, you overstayed your sort of break from the army, didn't you? Yes. So you were in trouble with the Israeli Defence Force for going AWOL, I guess.
That's right. AWOL, absolutely. AWOL. And when I got back to Israel, I wasn't... My unit was... they were in Lebanon at the time, and I was like... I just was in no space of mind to go all the way up to northern of Israel and continue that combat fighting that I'd been doing for the last year and a half or so before I'd gone on this lengthy break.
Yeah.
And then I got that knock on the door from the military police one morning. I went to visit my mother in Israel. She'd come to visit, and someone tipped her off, obviously. My mum claims it wasn't her, but, you know, to be honest, it wouldn't bother me because I'm glad that that it got resolved. But, it wasn't a particularly pleasant stay in that jail that time.
Hi, I'm Mia Friedman, and I have no filter. Not in life... Not in work, and especially not on my podcast. Every fortnight, I speak to some of the world's most interesting people about life, their career, and how they feel about things.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And tick. From Rosie Batty.
I think of Luke. I'm consumed with thoughts of Luke. You know, I dream of Luke. I wake up thinking of Luke. Yeah. I'm thinking of Luke even when I don't realise I'm thinking of Luke.
Yeah. To Taria Pitt.
Well, the fly was only 5 seconds of my life. I don't want to let that 5 seconds tell me who I am and what I can do and what I can't do in this world.
It's the podcast where too much information is never enough. Subscribe to No Filter in iTunes or your favourite podcast app.
Okay, so when did it really kick off in Australia for you and your family?
Well, I used to, in the early 2000s, so when I came back and I used to go to my parents' house that lived across the road on the Sabbath, David Tsipras, my second perpetrator, used to be standing there in charge of security in front of the synagogue often. And every time I used to walk past him and see him, he just dug a deeper hole, and I used to be angry, and he used to stand there and smirk at me.
Oh my God.
He used to stand there and just watch me walk like that, and I used to try to stare back at him, and I used to be so angry. To me, it was saying, we both know what happened and I got away with it. On occasion I had to go inside the yeshiva center because a brother was having a bar mitzvah, you know, some religious celebration. So I used to have to walk past him. And he was the person technically could say, you know, we can't let you in or something. And I used to stand there. And I knew that the yeshiva center leadership knew about him. That's the amazing thing.
Yeah, he had perpetrated before, hadn't he?
And they were told about it. We saw all of that in the Royal Commission. They were aware of about 5 cases before me.
In fact, I believe someone said to one mother, I thought he was cured.
That's right. I thought we'd cured him.
We thought we'd cured him.
Yeah, and that was before I was even abused. That was 86, 87. Wow. He started abusing me 88. So had they taken proper responsibility and addressed it properly back before it happened to me, there's a good chance they would have saved a few people from
being. So no wonder he was so arrogant.
Yeah, exactly. He felt he got away with it. So
you're a grown man back at your parents' house and he's standing across the road smirking at you.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that eventually just built up until it was too much.
Built up. I started working in the Jewish community. I caught up on my studies because I finished secular studies at the age of 12. So I needed to do my VCE equivalent and year 12. And then I did university after that, Bachelor of International Relations at La Trobe. Which was, you know, a challenge in and of itself because at the age of 25 to start to do your first English essay.
Wow.
You know, usually you go year 6, 7, 8. By the time you're year 12, you already have an understanding of how these things are supposed to work. Whereas, you know, my English language wasn't particularly great because I'd been living in Israel for 6 years speaking Hebrew.
Wow.
And so it was a lot of catch up. But it was a really a fun experience, especially going to university because, you know, VC kind of showed me that I can study a little bit and it could be interesting. And I had a lot of interesting experiences at university. My activism, I think, for the first time, I started getting involved in that area, mostly on the pro-Israel advocacy.
Yeah.
That led me to, as soon as I finished university, I got a position at in the Jewish community combating anti-Semitism. I was the head of the Anti-Defamation Commission of the B'nai B'rith. So it was kind of the Jewish community's anti-Semitism monitors or whatever.
So you were way back in the fold by that stage. Did your family feel that? You weren't, I don't know if you were Chabad.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I was back in the fold from the Jewish community perspective, but certainly not back in the fold from a religious or the Chabad community.
Okay.
Very, very big difference.
Okay.
And that's, I think, one of the big differences between the Catholic Church, for example, and the Jewish community, that if you leave your religion as a Catholic person, you're not really a Catholic anymore because it's a religion. Judaism is much more than a religion.
Yeah.
It's a culture, it's a history, it's a common language, it's an identity. It's a community.
Yes.
So there are many, most in the Jewish community are not religious.
Mm.
So I've always had that element of Jewish pride in me.
Mm.
Hopefully not.
Certainly the rest of the
world
always sees you as Jewish, whether you practice or...
Well, all Jews will see you Jewish. If you were born Jewish, to a Jewish mother, or you converted to Judaism in a halachic, in a Jewish law kind of way, then you will be forever be recognized as a Jew. Even if you go and become a Catholic, that's not recognized.
Okay.
Your stuff, that's it. You're Jew for life.
Jew for life. Wow.
So then I started working in that environment, and that's for the first time I actually understood the power of the media.
Yes.
Because that I was dealing with the media a lot on the issue of anti-Semitism, and that's when I started talking to my wife. You know, I've gone to the rabbi, I've gone to my senior rabbi, I've gone to the police, no one can help me. And this person, meanwhile, is standing in front of Yeshiva, having access to children. So it's not just about the justice in the past. It's about the fact that he's a danger to children today and the Yeshiva Center is not willing to do anything about it.
That's unbelievable.
Because I went back to Rabbi Groner, the late Rabbi Groner, and had a meeting in his office and said to him, you know, he's standing here doing security because we're dealing with it. He's seeing a therapist and I'm getting regular updates. I said, that's great, but can you assure me that he's no longer offending today or that he will not offend in the future by virtue of his position, access everywhere? And he said, no. And I just... How can someone do that? It was amazing to me. But I walked out and that was the end of it.
Yeah.
So, but then ultimately we decided we started having children.
Yes.
2004, 2006, 2008. And then we knew all the taboos and the stigma attached to this issue.
Mm.
And my wife and I discussed it. I wanted to disclose my story then, but we decided against it because of the kids. But then 2011 came along and there were a number of... developments that kind of made it more appropriate and right, felt more right for me to disclose it publicly, not least was because I was at the time the vice president of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, which is the peak body of the Australian Jewish community.
Wow.
So I moved to Canberra with my family. I became the president of the Jewish community there while I was working for government in counterterrorism, the Office of Transport Security. And, you know, that was interesting, but I have my views about working in the public sector, which are not all that favourable, to be honest. I guess I'm just not a natural public servant.
Yeah.
I feel too restricted.
Yeah.
But it was an experience as well, and I think I utilised that as well, that opportunity. But ultimately, in 2011, I just felt that enough, it was burning me, and I had to do it.
Yeah.
And then 8th of July 2011, it was out, front page of the Age newspaper.
Wow, and that was that. And then finally, what happened? Law enforcement finally were interested?
They had already gained some interest because they were getting some more material, information was coming to them. So they wanted to get in contact with me because they had heard my name involved. But there weren't enough people coming forward. And then suddenly, after my article, there were 15 victims in relation to David Tsipras who went to the police.
He's your first...
Second.
Second. Oh, that's right. This is the security man.
That's right.
Yeah.
The first one... went to live in America.
Okay.
He's been there since. Insufficient evidence to extradite him here.
And because
at this stage,
he's
never coming back, I suspect.
Yep.
I'm aware of two other alleged victims. So hopefully when they gather the courage to go to the police, because I've spoken to one directly and indirectly to another, it's difficult to go through a whole process of an extradition, and then you got to go testify and cross-examination. Hopefully they'll be ready, and then we can make sure that children are safe today, and also that he'll be held to account for what happened in the past.
So when after that did you make a documentary for the ABC? When would that have happened? Because I remember then seeing something that was but mostly about the community's reaction to you and your dad, and your dad was suffering terribly.
Absolutely, yes. Well, the documentaries came out. The first one, Code of Silence, was screened in 2014.
Right.
And then Breaking the Silence, which came out last minute kind of project as a result of what was going on at the Royal Commission, that came out in 2015. So they're both fairly new.
So tell us how the community reacted.
Look, in the beginning, in the first few days, was a lot of support. Finally, it's out there. We need to talk about it.
Okay.
So, you know, that was almost across the board. But then the attacks, even after the first week, because don't forget, I'm no longer Chabad, so I wasn't exposed to what was going on in the Chabad, in the Yeshiva Center behind the scenes. But I'm told that straight away they attacked, including this chief rabbi, Rabbi Telzner, at the Yeshiva Center, who made the notorious speeches, one to AVB, who's another victim who went through the Royal Commission process. They don't say his name, they use AVB. But then towards my father as well, which also threw him towards me, is the way I felt. Who gave you permission? Which is really the name of the book.
Yes.
Who gave you permission to speak out about this issue? Like, we needed to get the authorization, because ultimately his father-in-law, this rabbi's father-in-law, was the late Rabbi Groner. So his late father was getting scrutinized. That Yeshiva Center was getting scrutinized and attacked, criticized by many people, because we've all knew the secrets for decades.
Yeah.
Many people knew about it.
Also, the wider community is starting, I guess, to scrutinize, to even realize Chabad exists, and then go, hang on, who are these people?
Yes, yes.
So the whole community is being scrutinised.
That's right. Look, they reflected the broader Jewish community, and it was having a detrimental impact on all of us. I was walking down the street and people were saying to me, it's really not fair, because now the perception out there is that the entire Jewish community has got this problem, where really it's the Yeshiva Center and before that the Adas community. And I felt for them, and it was interesting. In the beginning, I was learning to be very careful with the words you use, you know, Jewish community, as opposed to, you know, when we talk about general matters, the Jewish community, but when we talk about this particular case, it's got to be the ultra-Orthodox or the Yeshiva Center, and being specific, not to tar everyone with the same brush. But then soon after, when you had organizations like the one I was a vice president of, the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, at some point I resigned because I was I no longer held the positions. They were getting involved in this issue, and they were almost critical of us. And I do get stuck into Danny Lamb, who was the president at the time. He gave a horrible interview, probably the worst interview, most offensive interview towards me and other victims, even though he didn't name us. But he was essentially standing by the Yeshiva Center's side, saying, I just got off the phone with them. They are fully cooperating with the police. They've assured me, and there is no, they're not going to leave any stone unturned in terms of justice and all of that. Meanwhile, you've got a police detective standing in court saying that there have been lies going on, that it's been very hard to crack. Even the district attorney in New York, just for people to understand the stranglehold of the leadership within the community, Mr. Hines, I forget his name, from who's a district attorney in the Brooklyn County in New York, which is a large Hasidic and ultra-Orthodox group. He said, I've been in law enforcement for over 20 years and dealing with the mafia, but nothing comes close to when you're dealing with the ultra-Orthodox community.
Wow.
More difficult than the mafia. Okay? So it's difficult for anyone who hasn't grown up in that kind of environment to really understand what it means to live in that kind of world, because they've got enormous power. Kids going into school at reduced fees. A lot of the community are reliant upon them for reduction of school fees, for jobs, for community stature, and all those types of things. And if you're on the outer with the leadership, you'll feel it. As my father felt it. No one wanted to even study Torah with him, to study the Bible with him. He used to study with a few senior people at the Yeshiva Center.
Yeah.
And then because of all of this, sorry, we can no longer study with you. It's shocking. It's no wonder he stopped becoming a Chabad follower.
Just
before the Royal Commission. He had a lot of question marks, and he took the decision on the eve, I think, on that day or the day before, to trim his beard, which is a massive, massive step. I mean, Chabad adherence, you've got to keep a beard. And his rationale for doing it then was, I'm going to be going to the Royal Commission every day, to the public hearing for 2 weeks. When people see me, they're going to think I'm a yeshiva person because I look like them. So he really wanted to take that physical separation of himself and the yeshiva center, and that made him feel a lot more different from that he could be recognized as a different person. And more and more over the last year or so, he's now made it very clear he's no longer Chabad. He regards Chabad as a cult. And look, many people do. People often ask me what I think about Chabad. I think they've got a lot of cult-like tendencies.
Wow.
But it's the fact that it all revolves around the one leader.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that closed community, you cannot criticize, you cannot say anything on the side, that offside.
Other sects refer to it as idol worshipping, don't they?
That's right. Many other sects were critical of Chabad itself as well. Mm-hmm. So, look, it's difficult because at the same time, I also admire and respect so much about Chabad in terms of, if I was genuinely religious and wanted to live in that kind of lifestyle, Chabad would be the place to go because it's so happy and so positive, and it's outreach. I criticize a lot of the things when I grew up with Chabad, but, they gave me a lot of the tools that I needed as well in terms of what I would regard as being my success, interacting with the outside world in terms of, Judaism is not a proselytizing religion,
mm-hmm.
but Chabad goes and does outreach between other Jews. So as a kid, a 10, 11-year-old, would have walked hours and hours in the pouring rain or in the hot sunshine, always with a suit and a jacket, just to find that Jew who's recovering, the old man in the hospital 3 hours away, to blow the ram's horn on Rosh Hashanah uh-huh. for him so he can hear that commandment, or to go and read the Bible for him, or to give him the fonts to shake the lulav. So just to go do a mitzvah, to make them feel good, to say a blessing. Because if we got them to do that, that would bring the Messiah a step closer. So many wonderful memories I honestly have of it. And I think about it. And it's just such a shame that all these other negative things, that they weren't able to address it. Because you know what? I never felt the Chabad needed to be perfect and even address these things perfectly because, times were different back then. Even us as a broader secular society, we dealt with things differently then.
Yeah.
And all they needed to do is to come out and say, mea culpa, we are sorry. We did make immense mistakes.
Mm.
What can we do to correct it? And I reached out to them numerous times through third parties so they can't deny and say, former classmates within the Yeshiva Center went to them. Manny is willing to talk to you off the record. He can sign a document, a confidentiality agreement that would forbid him to even acknowledge that he met with you. But just talk to him so you understand what the issues are, how you can progress. Our lawyers are dealing with it.
Yeah.
So if that's how they wanted to deal with it, I had no choice. And I had to get my lawyers involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to use my public campaign and my skills and connections to fight them almost. But it didn't need to be a battle. We all could have been on the same side, just like now we have almost come to be. It's not perfect. There have been many issues along the way. But at the same time, there's been incredible progress, positive developments at Yeshiva, and for that matter, more broadly in the Jewish world, around the world, and in many places. And it's been wonderful to see because, a lot of the members of the Jewish community who are in this field around the world have looked towards Australia and what's happened here. The Royal Commission was an incredible milestone for the Jewish world. Even broader than that,
yeah.
Exactly right, because, it was also sporting clubs within Australia.
Yeah.
So absolutely, but if I talk about the Jewish community, the impact wasn't felt only in the Yeshiva Center, which was the one under the investigation, or the Jewish community in Australia, which we are here living here, the impact was enormous. And there's a reason why it was the most widely watched Royal Commission on the live on the internet, was because many of the Jewish community in Israel, in America, were tuned in and watching it.
Yeah.
So it was such an important milestone that it did cause a massive shift in the Jewish world. It exposed them to things none of us were ever exposed to, seeing rabbis on the stand and finally accepting some responsibility, apologizing for what happened. All things they could have done a year, 2 years ago when they didn't have a gun to their head. So I can understand a lot of people are very cynical about it. Sometimes I get into that little cynicism, but I guess for me, I just want to move forward. I try to not forget the past, because you can't forget it. I've got that in my nightmares and my flashbacks. And I'm not talking about just the abuse. I'm talking about the nightmares of the fact that no one got up and supported us publicly.
Yeah.
There was not one leader, Orthodox or otherwise, mainstream Jewish community, who got up and said, this is disgusting what is going on here. Victims are being vilified and attacked, and it's unacceptable. Not one Jewish leader did that at any stage for years. We were the ones. I was the one who used to have to wake up every morning to look at the blogs, to look at the horrible things written about me personally, about my family. It was my family who felt they couldn't go to certain areas in the Jewish community because of the way they were being looked at or treated, or felt the negative energy from people because, you know, you are Manny Wax's wife or whoever. And it was hurtful. It was hurtful. And I had to put on this facade of, you know, I am the public spokesman. I had to put the family issues to the side as much as I could. Wasn't always able to do that. Mm-hmm. But I was the one giving a voice to the victims, to the voiceless. And I had to, therefore, keep as focused as I could. I did that for a while, but I guess it's all caught up with me, basically.
What makes you say that? Where are you at now? I mean, you're not living in Melbourne anymore. You've moved to Israel, right? As have your parents.
Yes. Well, we were chased out of Australia, is how we feel.
Wow.
There's no question. I mean, I feel like I'm in exile. In the last few years, you know, we tried to take a bit of a step back while focusing on a bigger picture type thing. So still involving myself in this field from a global perspective in the Jewish world, but wanted to focus less on victim support because, you know, there's my trauma, but then I deal with hundreds of victims hearing their traumatic experiences. And then when you multiply that, you know, year by year, it was just, you know, the trauma. It wasn't personal trauma only. It was also vicarious trauma.
Yeah.
And that's when you start getting nightmares about those types of things. When you hear a parent is telling you about the fact that he's just found out that a parent has been abusing their child for the last four years, and they have Sabbath meals with them every year. And, you know, the perpetrator and the victim are both there in the room at the same table. Mm-hmm. How do you address these things? And much more common story than people actually believe happens. It gets to a stage where, especially when I never dealt with my own stuff, in terms of therapy, I saw therapists here and there over the years, because that's another issue in ultra-Orthodox world, that you go to a therapist if you're weak, if you have issues, if you're crazy. Only then do you take things like medication. That's like another. So I had to break all those boundaries in my own mind about going to seek psychological help.
Mm.
And I never really did it. Even when I did, I forced myself. But it got to a stage where, you know, living with daily, especially in the last few years, anxiety. And I'm talking about anxiety. I've had anxiety on occasion. It was never an issue for me. But I'm talking about waking up in the morning and feeling difficulties breathing because of the heart is racing and you're like just taking deep breaths, lying in bed. And then, you know, when that goes away, or sometimes it doesn't come, and you're just feeling a sense of paralysis where I've got so much I need to do and my brain is saying, I've got a meeting here. I need to do this. I need to do that. But I'm just lying in bed, just physically and I guess emotionally unable to move. Just paralysis. And when you add on top of that depression, and when you add on top of that suicide ideation, where many days, I'll tell you, this morning was a tough one.
Really?
Getting, thinking, lying in bed, feeling like I want to be dead. It would make my problems go away. I will have peace. You know, when I hear someone die, someone I know, sometimes there's jealousy in me. It's so sad, but I know, but I just feel at least he's in peace now. He can't feel the pain. And it's, I know it's not a healthy way to think about it, but to me, what pushes it away from my mind really is my kids.
Yeah.
You know, and I say, I know I've got three kids. I cannot do it to them. It's just not right. And I use that sometimes consciously to get away from those negative thoughts, because I know that shakes me up. My kids, I love them obviously, and cannot give them that damage. I know that happens apparently when a parent commits suicide. But some days are harder than other days, but it's there often throughout the day, interspersed, where either it's a thought of just wanting to be dead, or a more active thought of I want to kill myself, and thinking about what ways I would do that. And it's destructive. Again, it impacts your entire day. Mm. And it goes around in circles, and you can't be around people. You just need your space. But then other times you're constantly seeking escapes. How do I escape? How do I escape from this pain? And I'm still uncomfortable talking about what I do as part of those escapes, but I have found those things. Obviously, I've got therapy and I've got friends. Occasionally there's alcohol and occasionally there's other things, but sometimes there's healthy things, sometimes unhealthy things. I try to do, meditation is not something that has come naturally. I can't sit still, but sometimes I just take some deep breaths and just go by myself a little bit and battle on.
But you're in regular counselling?
I'm in Israel. I go four times a week.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, and that is also difficult. I mean, going to counselling, I thought you go there and you feel better, but I'm getting psychoanalysis, so it's just preparing for each session, and then you're in the session for an hour, and then the rest of the day is almost a write-off because you just dealt with incredibly difficult things.
Are you medicated?
I just started that 2 months ago.
Again, as I said before.
Well, firstly, it was a big, big hurdle to go across because it's medication and I'm crazy. I need medication. It took a long time for my therapist to say, when people have flu, they go to medication.
You take your medicine. That's right. When people have cancer, they take the medication.
I'm starting to understand it and accept it.
You're such a fighter though, aren't you? It seems by nature you're a fighter and you must be tired of fighting.
Exhausted. I agree. You know, look, I am. I don't take things lying down. I remember even in the therapy course one of my therapy sessions, I was lying down and there was something that triggered me related to the Yeshiva Center here, and it was one of the most horrible experiences I've ever had, because I remember I got up, I was just crying, and I got up and I said, and I felt, my therapist lives across the road from the beach in Herzliya, and I needed to get up, and I said, I just need to get up, and walked around the room, made her a bit nervous, and I said, I just need to go out, and I went outside, and she said, okay, you don't need to go anywhere. I felt in my head I wanted to go to the beach and just walk with my clothes on into the beach, into the water, and just go and disappear and not come back. And, that felt, it felt like such a relief afterwards. But then, of course, I thought about the pain and I'm causing other people and all that. So that was difficult. But that's the level of the difficulty. But then I came back and I said to her, okay, I don't want to lie down. I can feel that it's going to be difficult, but they've taken so much from me. And I'm going to just fight back, and I'm going to force myself to lie back and just do it. And it was so hard to lie back, and I wanted to get up all the time, and the tears and the anxiety and everything. It was really a difficult fight back, but that's what she said to me, what you just said to me. You're a fighter. You will not give up. You will not give in. And as difficult as it is, and that's true. And I say, if it means I have to pay either a life sentence or ultimately a death penalty for it, then at the very least what gives me a bit of either satisfaction or vindication or the power and energy to continue is really the change that is happening in our community and the positive feedback from individual victims and their families. To hear the story, and they say, I've never been to a therapist, or I've never done this, or I've never gone to the police, and I've just heard your story, and I'm going to do that. And parents talking to their kids more about prevention. I'm now talking to my kids. That does give me hope, and it gives me the energy to continue even in those very difficult and dark times. In some ways, I feel like I have taken the path of more caring about the community than about my own family, because I have put that ahead, and it's not fair, and All I can say is I hope, really hope my kids will understand one day and forgive me for it.
Oh, I'm sure they'll more than understand. I'm sure they must be very, very proud of you. I mean, it's obvious to everyone, if it's not obvious to you, that you have saved so many other little boys who will never know that this could have happened to them. There are other men walking around Melbourne and walking around the world right now who have been allowed to grow up with that positivity that you had at 10, with that love for the community, with that, you know, with everything that was taken from you. And that's because of you, because of what you've done.
Yep.
We'll never know their names. We'll never know what could have happened to them if it weren't for you.
Look, and
your kids will know that.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I'm fortunate to know many of the names because they do contact me privately to let me know that. And I guess it's probably important for people to know the amount of attacks I get publicly is often, but also the amount of support I get both publicly and privately does create a bit of a balance.
Yeah. So. Oh, Manny, you're breaking my heart. I hope that you can find some peace.
Thank you.
Peace seems like a long way away from you. Does it feel that way to you? I mean,
it does.
Look, to be honest, I mean, sitting across from you, I think, It's not that far away from you, but you're such a fighter. You've got to learn to give up the fight at some point. Do you ever see that happening? Do you ever see a time when you'll say, okay, I've done my bit, I'm off now to...
Possibly. I think I write that in the book. I take it day by day. I'm going to try not to push the boundaries too much for what's healthy and what's good for me, but I don't feel I can stop yet. There is just too much to do. There is no one else doing what I'm doing in the Jewish community from a global perspective. There are a few individuals working in their local communities, sometimes in the US and in Israel, but there's no one coordinating everything, what's going on and having that interaction. And that's kind of my big vision and dream, is to be able to do that and really change the conversation broadly in the Jewish community. And that is happening. We'll see that in another generation or two, but for as long as I feel like I can do it, I'll do it. It's not going to be lifelong, I suspect, but I'm hoping to, for the time that I am able to do it, to give it the best shot.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm doing as much as I can in this public space.
Oh, thank you so much. I can't thank you
thank
enough.
Thank you.
I'm such a big fan of yours. Just stay alive, yeah?
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you.
Thank you. The music you're listening to and you've heard throughout this podcast is a traditional Tibetan Buddhist song. It's dedicated to the Medicine Buddha. It's believed by Tibetans to promote peacefulness and healing, which I'm sure is what we all wish for Manny. The song is performed in this instance by my friend Tenzin Choyul, and you can find it on his album called Tibet Awakened Heart, which is available on iTunes. If you're struggling with suicidal feelings, I would urge you to call Lifeline on 13 11 14.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.